Juan Uribe, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
And we're very happy to have you here and discuss such an interesting theme, right? You announced CriticGPT back in June alongside a paper, which is here in the description, actually, detailing the whole system. But just so we can make sure we're all on the same page, could you give a high-level description of the problem that CriticGPT solves and how it goes about doing that?
All right. So highest level problem that we're trying to face here is supervising AI that is more capable than human supervisors. So in the current paradigm that we train ChatGPT, we basically have humans look over ChatGPT's answers and figure out if it's good or bad. And that's sort of how we train it. But that doesn't really work when the AI is smarter than people. And that's already very realistic. Like, there's a lot of coders already. Like, you ask for code and you get something that you wouldn't have come up with yourself. So you can imagine it would be hard to supervise that code. So that's like the big problem. And we can call that problem scalable oversight. That's a big idea. And then the way that we went about this is basically we didn't come up with like a very crazy methodology. We just said, let's make a reasonable methodology and actually prove that those trainers that are seeing that code are actually more effective. So I think the main contributions of the paper are, one, finding a methodology that actually kind of works for training that critic model, but two, also is actually evaluating it on production data, which is something that hadn't been done before.
And basically, like, this is something to be implemented during the RLHF process, right? The GPT. Or are you thinking about creating something to be used also afterwards or on itself?
Right. So what we were thinking about was using it in the training pipeline. So those trainers that are like giving training signal to ChatGPT based on whether its answers are good or bad, they would have access to CriticGPT. And then we show that they can do a better job when they have access to CriticGPT. But you could also think about deploying it in some other ways. We didn't really think about that, but it's reasonable to, yeah.
And what were the most specific challenges that you face when you were trying to train the CriticGPT?
Some of the biggest challenges might have been coming up with evaluations that work, because let's pretend for a minute that we are trying to evaluate our human trainers. So what do? We get some questions that we know the right answers to, and we show them to the trainers. That's what we call them here, like data labelers. Show them to the trainers and they answer each question. And then we go back over the test and check when they were right and they were wrong. That's like what you would do. But the problem is that we're actually trying to do this for problems that are too hard for humans. So you can't do that. So you try to come up with those questions that you know the answer to, but you don't know the answer to them. So that's like the key issue is how do you evaluate them when you don't know the answer yourself? And yeah, the main piece of the methodology actually deals with that problem directly.
Right. And my next question touches a little bit on alignment, I think. And since you are an AI alignment research engineer, I think you're the person to ask that. It's about CriticGPT. In the post presenting CriticGPT, it says the following: as we make advances in reasoning and model behavior, ChatGPT becomes more accurate and its mistakes become more subtle. This can make it hard for AI trainers to spot inaccuracies when they do occur, making the comparison task that powers RLHF much harder. I thought that this was fascinating because it speaks to one of the issues that are usually brought up when we talk about RLHF, which is the model sort of craves that thumbs up. So there's a risk that it might try to not actually do what it was requested, but make it seem like it did so we can get a thumbs up, right?
Yes.
So when I read that as we make it more advanced, the mistakes become more subtle, I think that it might not be on purpose or maliciously, but that might happen. Was that a problem or a concern when you came up, developed CriticGPT?
That's part of it for sure. I think that's like how it plays out in practice, that trainers don't know what to do, so they just would pick the output that looks the best. But actually, when you're the user, when you're the actual programmer, and you're in the middle of your workday trying to get some real code out of ChatGPT, of course it doesn't work. So that's definitely part of it. I think that's, yeah, how it ends up looking at how the error looks in practice. That was part of the motivation. I think the main motivation is the big problem of scalable oversight, which is, in general, how do we train very powerful models? And the main problem would be that we create some extremely powerful AI, say we create AGI, but we haven't figured out scalable oversight. So what we get is this super intelligent machine, but we don't really know how to tell it how to act. So it just starts acting randomly, and that potentially is way more risky than like getting some bad code, which is what happens right now.
It's basically that example. I think it was, I forgot the name of the guy who gave it, but like that you're going to try to use an AGI or an ASI even like to mine iron. And then it's going to start to mine the iron in buildings and people's bloods and this kind of stuff, right? Like,
correct. Yeah, I think that's along the lines that we were getting at, that this work was done in the context of the super alignment team, which was basically tasked with avoiding those kind of risks, which we could call misalignment risks, where a model competently does the wrong thing.
Going back to Critic GPT now, you had to basically, when you read the article, you see that you use real mistakes that humans made, but you also try to temper some correct code to introduce like some fake mistakes or some, yeah, this kind of stuff, some subtle bugs, let's say. So how can you make sure that this kind of bugs that you're trying to introduce there in a fake way, that they are representative, that they are realistic of human made bugs?
I think that's a great question, and that was a key concern throughout the project. We're getting these people to mess with the code, and that's how we train Critic GPT, but then it's a different distribution for sure, the distribution of the bugs that people can come up with and introduce after the fact, and the bugs that actually occur kind of in the wild for ChatGPT, which is what we were trying to get at. And so I think that's a real difference, and the thing that we do about it is also like evaluate on bugs that happen in the wild. And so it doesn't really matter how you train it. You know, you could do whatever crazy, absurd sounding thing in training, but in evaluation, you need to be evaluating the right thing. So what would be cheating is if we evaluate only on human inserted bugs, like the ones that we trained on. That would be cheating because we literally trained our model to catch those bugs. But that's not the like deployment problem that matters. So what we do is we get a different stream of data of naturally occurring model bugs, and we evaluate on that. So yeah, to put it shortly, the way that we deal with it is evaluate on the real distribution, regardless of what we do in training.
And how about the naturally occurring distribution of bugs? How did you get that?
Yeah, so we had two main streams of data. The training stream of data, what it looked like was people would be looking at production model code. So that's code that somebody got from ChatGPT, and then think about a way to make it worse and introduce that bug. Then what we ended up with there was code that has a known bug. So that's very cool because it allows us to have like kind of taking it back to the beginning, get that test where we do know the answers. We have some code and some bugs that the trainer is supposed to find out. So that's really the important thing because we can evaluate it later. But for naturally occurring bugs, that was a little tougher. And what we did was we went back over data that we already had from a lot of ChatGPT training data collection. And we picked out some like justifications of problems that previous trainers had written before and sort of did something to verify that they were reasonable, that they were actually good justifications. And so that code had never been tampered with, but actually humans found bugs in the code before. So yeah, that's like more similar to the natural distribution of code that we're interested in. And I'll make the caveat that it's still not exactly the distribution that we're looking for, because what we would wish to have if we wished upon a star is to know some ChatGPT code and to actually know every single bug that was there. We don't have that. We only have bugs that another human detected before. So we do know for sure that this bug, with very good certainty that those bugs are real and that code has those bugs, but there might be way more bugs and it's still like the particular bugs that other humans detected.
Do you see a path for that? Or is it one of those intrinsic problems of the way that the whole thing is built?
So right now it feels like that's something that you are just going to have to deal with, that there is like incomplete information. Yeah, I'd be more excited about methodologies that try to like sidestep that inconvenience instead of like facing it directly, because I think it might just not happen, which is kind of what we did, right? We were like, I don't really know how to find all the bugs. So let's do something a little different and just like insert some bugs and train like that and prove that the model that comes out the other way is a reasonable and good model.
Right. And from the way you're talking about CriticGPT, it seems that you're sort of an outlier when compared to people who come here on the podcast to talk about a breakthrough model, breakthrough way to check, especially on training, because it's always by accident, right? Now, we were investigating something else and turns out that this thing really helped on this other problem. Did that happen with you as well? Or were you dead set on this objective from the beginning and you got there?
I think the seed for the project was the whole code tampering idea. And we had some impression, even before I joined the team, actually, there was like an impression that that would be very useful to solve that problem of like lack of access to ground truth labels. So I would say it was actually pretty deliberate where we got. It wasn't clear, like the way that we would evaluate later on with human detected code, that was absolutely unknown. That we figured that out like 2 months before the paper came out was when we came up with that. So yeah, somewhere in between, the tampering thing was always there. That was the idea that like gave birth to the project. And how are we going to use that to make impact in scalable oversight was the seed. And we sort of got there.
Looks like it.
Yeah. And also like another thing that you mentioned in the article is that you use the FSBS strategy. So like for sampling being searched. Can you explain more about like how it works and what is its role in analyzing CriticGPT's performance?
Yeah. So that algorithm is pretty in the weeds. So it's harder to understand. But I think that it's actually some of the cooler contributions in the paper. So there's a problem that we ran into as we trained CriticGPT, which is that our main source of signal for training better critics became whether their critiques included those inserted bugs. That's what humans were like using to train better critics. Maybe let me take a step back and say, how did we train the critics? Very much like we trained ChatGPT, which is we took our critics, asked them to criticize some code. The critic would generate 4 different versions of its critique. And then a human rater would rank them like this is better than this, and this is better than this, and this is better than this. But that was easier because they literally had just inserted a bug in it. So they could figure out themselves whether or not each critique had that bug. So that's why it's like easier, better than ChatGPT, because it's like your job is easier. You literally just inserted the bug. That has a problem that we realized after our first versions of the critic, which is that the main training signal becomes bug inclusion, that the critique has the bug. And so what our critics, a very good strategy, if you're our critic GPT and you're being trained to catch a lot of bugs, what's a great strategy? You just start criticizing everything. You just start saying, I don't like this line because this import should have never happened. And this is like misspelled. Or you just start trying your best to like say that something is wrong. So what you get is really long critiques where like most of the stuff is really useless. And that's not good. And why is that not good? Because later, if you were to show a human labeler that critique, they would spend more time looking through the critique than they would like actually trying to rate ChatGPT's code. So that's a real issue. And we actually ran into that like as we went. And so we started thinking what can we do to like navigate how long or short the critique should be. So one thing you could do is try to strike that perfect balance and really try to train CriticGPT to give you the exact length of critique that you would want. Just say the important things and not the non-important things. Well, it turns out that it's actually really hard to agree on like what's that perfect balance. What we found is that some human trainers would think, oh yeah, this is great. This was important. And some others would think, oh, this last part is a detail. So I would have actually preferred like just the first statement in this critique. It's very hard to agree on what's actually a part of a critique that matters and which ones don't. So instead, the approach that we took was to make another algorithm, which is called FSBS. That's actually due to Maya, who's a co-author in the paper. And her idea was, instead of trying to strike the perfect balance, let's make another algorithm that goes on top of CriticGPT and allows it to like squeeze more juice out of the critic if you want more. So this is, in this sense, FSBS is an inference technique. We start using it after CriticGPT is done. Let me make a caricature of how I would use CriticGPT plus FSBS. I'm a human trainer. I get some ChatGPT code. I have no idea what if it's good or bad. So I ask for Critic GPT's advice. It gives me three statements. I think, okay, this is reasonable. Can you say more? That's what FSBS does. It asks Critic GPT to say more. And then maybe the next thing was also important. So you say like, okay, cool, say more. And then the next thing is actually not that useful. So you stop there.
It's kind of like an agent. So it's like,
it's very much on those lines. Yeah. Mm-hmm. We didn't think about it that way, but yeah, for sure.
And of course, its main applicability seems to be in code, but are there, you actually, it's sort of mentioned in the paper, but I'd like to hear a little bit more about other applications in other domains. How else could Critic GPT be used and be useful when it comes to interacting with the model?
Yeah, so I think in any context, it would be super useful. We'll want scalable oversight in pretty much any domain. In the paper, we use code, because we think it's an especially important behavior to get right. Because I think we could go on talking about that for a long time. But basically, we think that making sure that models don't output vulnerable code is really important. So that's why we chose code. But that's really it. But there's other domains that are really important. And actually, we did find some generalization from Critic GPT into other domains, which was pretty unexpected. Like, we didn't do anything about it. It just sort of happened that when we plugged it into other streams of data collection, I think one that had to do with math. I specifically didn't work on that part of the paper, so I don't know it very well. But the gist of it is, it sort of had some nice generalization properties. And that was cool because it was completely an emerging capability that we didn't plan for.
And we see in the article some of the benchmarks you use and the metrics, but can you speak more about this? Like, how a human could benefit from using Critic GPT together when they are analyzing code in comparison to just a human by themselves or ChatGPT by itself?
Right. So that gets into how we evaluated people using Critic GPT. The way we set that up is we basically made a ChatGPT normal data collection campaign, which is what we call them. And we did the test. We gave half of the trainers access to Critic GPT. We didn't give access to half of them. And then we tried to see what the outcomes were. And then we found out some pretty interesting things, which are first that the humans that have access to Critic GPT indeed catch more bugs. That was kind of to be expected, but I'm glad it worked out. That's like a good result. But then the other thing that was really interesting is that the human plus AI team hallucinated less bugs than just the AI. So yeah, when we just got critiques from Critic GPT, it has that problem that it just like wants to complain about more things. And so in the process of that, it ends up just making things up or pointing problems out that aren't really problems. And that is extremely mitigated when you team up Critic GPT with a human. So there's like some cool collaboration where Critic GPT is able to find more bugs, but humans are better able to catch bullshit, mainly. So when you put them together, you strike a very nice balance because you get both.
Right. And you might not be able to answer this question, but if you can, are you guys using Critic GPT internally as a tool actually for developing code?
I think what I can answer is we are studying it. I'm actually not exactly sure whether it's like currently in a pipeline, and I couldn't tell you like this is ChatGPT's pipeline,
right?
But I know that we're trying it. I don't think that has conclusion. That project, that's like an entire project on its own now.
Another one that you may not be able to answer, but it's completely okay. When you are creating a Critic GPT, is it like a fine tuning from GPT-4 or from another model like that you have only internally? And how different is it when you compare the size like to GPT-4, GPT-4o to a Critic GPT?
Yeah, I can totally answer that because it's in the paper. So for the paper, we really wanted to compare Critic GPT to just using ChatGPT. You know, you could just... Actually, human labelers do that, where they ask a hard question to ChatGPT to help figure out how they should rate ChatGPT. They already do that. So that comparison was really important for us. And for that reason, we made Critic GPT the same series as the ChatGPT that we had access to, which is from some point last year. I don't know which one specifically, but we did make sure that there's like the GPT-4 that came out in that technical report. But there's like more iterations of the like flagship GPT-4 that came out. So I don't know exactly which one it is, but the thing to note here is that the ChatGPT that we show in the paper and the Critic GPT are like sibling models. They both come from the same GPT-4. Because if they didn't, that would really mess up your evaluation. You could argue like, oh, but actually you did Critic GPT on top of like GPT-4o, which has like another year of research, which is a very long time. So they come from the same family. I don't think we tried like using more recent models like 4o or we haven't tried.
But basically, so they are the same size. You didn't do like some pruning to eliminate some data that is not useful for a code critic.
That's another thing that we had to like make equal for the comparison to be fair. Mm-hmm. So it's important. The more you train a model, the smarter it gets, right? So it would be really unfair if we start out at the same GPT-4, but then ChatGPT, which is use the production model, which trains on a lot of data. And then Critic GPT, we clearly had less data. So that would have been really unfair. That would, our Critic GPT would have been at a disadvantage. So we do have some, this is like a smaller section in the paper in the ablation section. We have a version of ChatGPT that trains on the same amount of compute as Critic GPT, which is really the fair comparison to make. And once you do that, you find out that Critic GPT is a lot more efficient in terms of like, you train a Critic GPT and a ChatGPT with the same number of data points, and Critic GPT ends up being a much more effective critic in terms of finding more bugs and hallucinating less.
Right. And the tool is very useful for catching code bugs, which is awesome if you're trying to catch code bugs. But it might be very useful for a malicious purpose of someone trying to find a vulnerability in a bug to try to exploit it. So how did you go about dealing with that, trying to make Critic GPT as useful as possible, but at the same time, thinking about potential misuses, actually?
Yeah, that's a good question. I have honestly thought less about this. To be fair, I think it's a problem that is already out there, as in you could use ChatGPT like and ask it to find code vulnerabilities, and that would suck. I don't have a very big opinion on this. I think it's one of those problems where like both the attack and the defense become stronger because, well, technically the developers also have ChatGPT and they could debug their own code. So it does end up being like a less stable situation for cybersecurity, I think, because now like more people are able to find vulnerabilities because of ChatGPT. So yeah, I think that's the reality.
And you mentioned also the limitations the Critic GPT has when analyzing super long code or complex code or hallucinations, this kind of stuff. So what are the things that you are trying, or are you trying to do some things to solve these limitations right now as part of, I don't know, a next level Critic GPT or a next paper that is going to be published at some point?
Currently, there is no open project that is further improving Critic GPT that I know of. Let me think. I wouldn't say there's so much as a direct continuation, but rather there's at least people thinking on different kinds of problems that we didn't address. Like one big problem that we didn't address is calibration. So what I mean by that is currently we have trainers just say this is good and this is bad, but we don't have mechanisms for expressing uncertainty, which would be great. That would be even better if you could say like, well, I think that like this completion is like probably better than this one, but I'm like not a Java expert, so I don't know, could be. And if critics could potentially help you do that, to like realize the things that you don't know. I actually have a cool anecdote about this, which is that we were kind of testing the limits of Critic GPT. We applied this to this data set that's called GPQA, which has PhD level problems, the really hard problems. And so I asked Critic GPT to like help me figure out this really hard physics problems. And I found that when I read the critique, I didn't even understand the words. So like it was absolutely impossible for me to evaluate the thing because I didn't understand anything. But one thing that I think Critic GPT could have made me realize would have been like, you need like 5 years of physics expertise for this. this is just like a really hard physics problem, you know? And so I think the right question answer for me as a physics data labeler would have been, I don't know. CreditGPT doesn't do that in its current form. It doesn't help you figure out that things are hard and you don't know. And RLHF also has no room for I don't know, which really sucks, because that is a, I don't know the answer to the physics answer. The best thing for me to do is to not say anything, because I'm just going to get it wrong. And there are people thinking about calibration. So I think I'll actually walk back like, oh, there is no more scalable oversight work. There is definitely different flavors of scalable oversight work going on at OpenAI.
When you talk about scalability, is a topic that you mentioned a lot of times here. RLHF is not super scalable when you think about it, because you need to have like actual people there that understand the topic, like we talked a lot of times here. Are you planning, like in your research, in your future research, of applying other types of algorithms there, like such as DPO, for example, to try to create a new level, like a new CreditGPT or another solution that you would you like to research?
Yeah. So I think there's many ways that you could potentially solve the problem of training or aligning superhuman models. One way that you might do that is by scalable oversight, which for scalable oversight, you try and make humans actually able to evaluate the code. And so that erases the problem. That's one thing you could do. A different work stream is about generalization. There was an OpenAI paper about generalization where instead of enabling humans to label really hard code, you figure out the science of generalization and in a way that you can train your model with just easy data, but then expect it to behave well with very hard problems. So actually models do generalize a bit. They do indeed seem somehow better able to code than their trainers. So they do some of that generalization to harder problems yet. What would be a solution? If you figured out like a certain science of generalization that allows you to claim that it's going to happen and that we're going to be okay. So generalization could also work as well as scalable oversight. And yeah, I think a more recent work stream that I'm very interested in is called AI control, much like your podcast, which the objective is to monitor models as they act. So we're monitoring a superhuman model that's like, I don't know, writing you a web page. And this monitor is going to call out bad behavior and block it. So this is a really different approach, because in the first two, you are really making the model interiorize the good behavior and never do the bad thing. But AI control is about catching the model doing the bad thing and ensuring safety in that way.
Doesn't that already happen?
Yes, but not at the level where we would want. There is a lot of monitoring for like what I would call more like day-to-day safety. Like it's great if ChatGPT doesn't output like child pornography, hopefully. So we do have a lot of monitoring for content policy like that. And it's really good. It's almost solved. It's really good. But what it doesn't do is monitor for like very intelligent, possibly bad behavior. So I'm going to say an example, say the model is trying to break free from our data centers. That's a behavior that's way more complex. It's going to happen through exploiting code vulnerabilities, maybe persuading a person to put the model weights in a USB. So it's way more complex behavior that actually happens at this superhuman level. Because humans don't understand child pornography when we see it. So it's still in that domain of like, it's easy enough that we can figure it out. But AI control tries to take care of superhuman behavior and how you can monitor for that.
And that's why we always say please and thank you to ChatGPT, right?
Yeah, it's important. And to say good morning.
Right. And Juan, you've been working with machine learning since 2017, it seems, from your LinkedIn, I think that was it, right? So you got in way, way before the whole AI, Gen AI actually boomed from 2022. And we have many listeners who are looking to get into the market now. They're interested in starting to learn. And one might feel that it's so far ahead now, so much that you have to learn to just get into the game. So what would you tell a young student, or not a young student, but actually someone who's starting to study AI machine learning now? How should they go about learning? What should they prioritize? Because it seems like it's such a vast field that sometimes you don't really know where to start.
I'm listening.
Yeah, I think that's a good question. So I'll say something before I give our recommendation, which is I think generative AI is in a place where there's not a lot of tooling yet. So there's still a lot of value in like individuals who really know all the details of the algorithms and can actually like train their own models and stuff like that. That was when I got started in data science back in 2017, when I came out of college in 2019. That was the state of data science, I feel, where like companies had no clue how to do like analytics, at least in Colombia. And so they would hire like a physicist or a mathematician fresh out of college that would like be able to implement a support vector machine or like some random forests and understand this ML and try to do something reasonable. But as time went by, the tooling for analytics really started to get developed. So like now you didn't need that person that was going to do the random forest and like do all the hard math work themselves, because tooling started coming up. Now you have like Databricks, a lot of enterprise software that solves all that analytics that recent graduates were doing. So I have the vibe that we're sort of in that scenario for Gen AI, where there's like not much tooling, so it feels like you need a genius. But it's happened before where tooling starts to be built, and in the end, the people that build tools always end up having a job and getting the larger bite of the cake. So I think that for like my generation, the people that started to focus on like data engineering and building around tools to move around data, maybe they weren't the massive like math expert or whatever, but the math became solved by the tooling. And in the end, the people that knew the infrastructure, I think, started to become way more valuable. So I think that things that never die are like infrastructure and software engineering. It just never dies. And it's a different thing if like you are super interested in the algorithms themselves. I think you can just follow your heart. You know, it's cool. I think it's still the early days. So I would be pretty confident that the field is going to continue to grow.
On that, it's very interesting that you mentioned like software engineering is never going to die, because there was Jensen Huang from NVIDIA mentioned like some days ago, like in the future, we're not going to have developers anymore, but not exactly that. But he said that like you're going to communicate to the computers in a natural language, and basically GPT is helping do that, right?
That's an interesting point. Yeah, I'm really uncertain about some parts of the future of coding, because I feel like there's two effects that could happen. The first one is that it becomes way easier to code because now everybody has ChatGPT, and ChatGPT is a great coder. And so because it's so easy to code as a company, maybe instead of 10 software engineers, you hire one. That's the sad future. But there's another happy future and I don't know which one it's going to be. In the happy future, that same company that has 10 software engineers realizes that the marginal gain, that the return on investment of every extra engineer is like 10x. So you get, now there's like a lot more money in the table. So then you hire 20 software engineers because you're making more money by the engineer. And I don't know which one of those it's going to be. You see what I mean? It's like hard to guess.
Yeah. Yeah, it touches on that lump of labor fallacy, right? That we tend to think that we have this finite amount of work that you have to do. And if you have a 10x productivity gain, you can cut the equivalent part of the team. No, no, no. You're still going to have more work. And that's exactly what you said. Like, you can actually 10x your productivity on new stuff, on new projects, on better projects. It's not like this finite thing that you're, okay, I'm out of stuff to do. My work is done here. I'll just retire because I don't have anything else to do on my to-do list.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's not like we're short of problems to solve. So like my guess would be like, yeah, there's going to be even more software engineers because now it's going to be easier and it's going to be even more profitable.
And nowadays, what is your day-to-day there at OpenAI?
Yeah. So my day-to-day has, I would say there's like 10% of my time is writing documents and trying to convince people that things are good ideas. Some 5% reading other people's documents and figuring out if they're good ideas. There is, like some 50% of my time has got to be coding for 60, 70. Yeah, there's every time that you come up with an experiment, actually way more than 70%. Every time that we figure out, okay, this is a good idea. Now let's do it. And then you have to code it out. And that actually ends up being a huge chunk of the time. And these days I don't work with humans a lot, But before, historically, I've spent a lot of time working with human data labelers. Yeah, I think it turns out to be really hard to agree on things. You write some instructions that the human labelers are supposed to follow, and you say like, okay, yeah, this is perfectly clear. We're this is totally gonna work. And then you actually realize that they come up when they go and look through the data, they usually have very, very good questions. And so I find that like keeping that back and forth with human labelers historically has led to like actually refining algorithms and the research direction. So yeah, I used to spend a lot of time with humans. Now not so much.
People are going to get very mad at me if I don't ask, if you can say it, of course, what are the languages that one should know if they want to try to work at OpenAI, the programming languages?
Everything I ever do is Python. But I will say that I live in like a very abstract layer of the OpenAI infrastructure, because there's definitely like, I'm not like the GPU ninja that's going to figure out how to speed up gradient descent or something. There's GPU ninjas here, and I'm sure they have to do a lot that's not Python. So I think those are the real heroes. Maybe also on the side of jobs that are not going away is like infrastructure platform engineers. Like, I don't know, that's gonna, if anything, I think that's just gonna kick off and explode out the roof. So yeah, I stay on a very abstract layer, so I only have to deal with Python. These days, it's still a good idea to know like PyTorch, maybe. But at least at large companies, there's many times where you don't even have to deal with that. So for me personally, most of the stack is already implemented. So you'd imagine like, yeah, for me, things look like running a method that's called like .train, and it sort of does the expected thing. If you're at a smaller startup, you probably don't have access to that. So you'll need to be more hands-on. But yeah, as the stacks become like more established, I think there will be maybe a little less of a need for everybody to know how to implement a transformer on PyTorch. And people might be able to focus on more abstract things.
Yeah, I saw a meme even this week. It was like a AI engineer interview. So like you have to explain every detail of a transformer, how it works and blah. And then like a AI engineer real job, import transformers, basically.
Yeah, I never know what's the like right balance for advice there, because it's hard to tell when you'll need to know something. You know, if you look at like the day-to-day life, it's like, yeah, I didn't implement a transformer today, but maybe one day you'll be at work and you'll be trying to figure out why is this thing not training. And then you'll be invited to think, you'll start to think about your loss function. And then you might start to think about, you know, back to those basics. So it's weird. I think it's hard to define, but I think right now the basics, there's basics that I would skip today. Like I would just skip through like random forests and classic ML. I think it's like, nice to know, but that used to be far more important. But the paradigm for generative AI is deep learning. And in deep learning, you spend way less time understanding how algorithms work and way more time just empirically testing that they actually work. So maybe that's a piece of like very concrete advice. Classical machine learning algorithms are, I think, pretty outdated. If you're interested in Gen AI, just focus on deep learning. And more specifically, focus on transformers. Transformers are taking over everything. So yeah, your time is better spent thinking more about transformers than, I mean, do one project where there's a convolutional neural network, but the rest is the transformers, because that's what people are doing for all sorts of algorithms now. Yeah.
And Juan, my last question for you, this is not about the future of OpenAI. It's more of an open question for AI in general. What's exciting you about the future? What is one subject, one issue, some technology that you would tell people, pay attention to this because this might be big in the future. This is promising. This is interesting. Let's look at this. What's exciting you about what's coming?
I start by saying I'm a safety researcher, so I'm excited by things that could help us be safe from AI. I think one thing that is very exciting is researching AI control. Actually, there is a recent paper that introduced this sort of framing of the problem. It's called AI control safety in spite of intentional subversion, something like that. And the paper just basically lays out the problem of monitoring an AI that is intentionally trying to do bad things. And I think this is cool because it's an alternative route. So I think this ties actually very nicely with our conversation. We knew about the routes of scalable oversight. We were thinking about that. There's great progress in that. We knew about the route of studying generalization. There's some progress in that. But I think AI control is something that we actually hadn't thought about. We hadn't put a lot of thought in really like supercharging monitoring for very complex AI. And so that's starting out. Yeah, so if you're like a starting safety researcher, I would definitely recommend that as a like one direction that I think is going to see a lot of progress in like the next year or so. I'm also excited about regulation becoming more relevant and coming to the table. California is looking into regulation right now. Of course, there's like many contentions between the labs and the state right now, but regulation is on the table. And it wasn't like a couple of years ago. So I think it's very good that governments are kind of waking up to the need to regulate frontier AI. Some countries already have AI safety institutes. The United States has an AI safety institute. The UK has one. So that's another thing. Like regulation and government bodies are really starting to pop up. And that makes me feel hopeful that we're not gonna like wander off into the abyss. Yeah.
Juan, thank you very much for your time, for sharing your knowledge with us. If folks want to maybe continue this conversation with you directly, where should I go?
Yeah, first, very much thanks for having me. I love to talk about our work more. And you can reach me at juan@openai.com. You can talk to me directly. I'd be happy to answer questions about the paper, future work. Also, always happy to talk about starting professionals who are like struggling to find out what the right steps are to take. My career isn't very long yet, so I feel like I have pretty good advice there because I started my career in AI research like 3 years ago.
Right. Thank you very much. And congratulations on your work and the work that everyone at OpenAI has been doing. It's been very inspiring and pretty cool to see this unfolding real time. Thank you very much once again.
E olha só, se você aqui que está escutando o episódio também está afim de talvez um dia trabalhar com o Juan, ajudar a evoluir nesse mercado, o recado é o seguinte, a Alura está prestes a dar o maior desconto do ano com bônus exclusivos por conta da Black Friday. Então chegou a hora de você construir o seu futuro, né, em tecnologia com o maior desconto do ano. Você pode se inscrever na lista VIP da Black Friday da Alura para receber as novidades em primeira mão e garantir bônus exclusivos que são limitados antes que ele acabe. Então aqui na descrição do episódio tem o link para você se inscrever na lista VIP e receber antes de todo mundo e junto com o pessoal que se inscreveu. Ó, se você não se inscrever, vai ter gente se inscrevendo, vai ter uma vantagemzinha. Então você se inscreve, recebe junto com esse pessoal as informações todas de como você vai aproveitar o seu desconto, dos bônus exclusivos também, antes que eles acabem. Então mais uma vez, passa na descrição, pega o link, lista VIP Black Friday da Alura com o maior desconto do ano para você aproveitar, não perde. Pessoal, obrigado como sempre pela audiência de vocês, pelos likes, pelos comentários, está movimentada a área de comentários do Spotify. Vi que o pessoal está deixando reviews também lá no Apple Podcasts, ou estrelinha, ou review por extenso mesmo. Obrigado quem tira um tempinho do dia para fazer isso. E obrigado também a quem recomenda o IA Sob Controle, afinal, mais gente semana após semana, ou duas vezes por semana, está chegando por aqui para se informar sobre inteligência artificial. Então, como são duas vezes por semana, na sexta-feira, eu e o Fabrício estaremos de volta aqui com, é claro, um resumão aí, muitas notícias sobre o mundo da inteligência artificial. Até lá!
Este podcast foi produzido pela Alura. Mergulhe em tecnologia. E Faculdade FIAP. Let's Rock the Future. Edição Rede Gigahertz de Podcasts.